Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crime
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan.
And happy Thursday.
Happy
Thursday.
This is
episode 148.
You got it. Woohoo.
I'm a freaking beast
look at
today.
You. Look at all my awesomeness.
We are doing YouTube again. I got it up. It took me a week. I'm going to have to get back into the swing of it. So right now they're going to be released the following Thursday or before.
Or before.
Yeah. I technically have 147 already uploaded when you're listening to this.
It
came out yesterday,
egg
right?
Theory.
Oh, so then no. I have 146 uploaded. Yeah. It was supposed to go out yesterday. We're recording this on the Friday before this comes out. And we didn't do... Oh, we did. We have Egg Theory on.
Yeah, we'll have the Egg Theory.
We'll have Egg Theory.
Yeah, so this is kind of what happened with the last week's episode and the current one right now is that I covered something so ridiculous, like the Egg Theory. And Taylor's case today is like very...
There's going to be a lot of like trigger warnings.
Yeah,
for it.
It's very sensitive and tragic.
Not that any other case that we would put beside that one isn't. It's just that this one involves children. So it's a lot different.
Right. And it was not like two, like the egg
the theory two together
was just like not really a good vibe. So
we were just questioning a lot by the end of it.
Yeah. So we had re-recorded something, a different segment. Taylor whipped up some notes because she's like a note chef, you know, and we recorded that on mic. So that half isn't on the camera.
That half isn't on the camera. So it'll only be the egg theory that you guys get to see and the intro.
And then today, because this case is so detailed, I mean, I'm like stealing your thunder here. Like, I'm, I don't
I'm
know what I'm
about
saying,
it.
But because this case is so detailed
and long
talking
today.
I don't really know I don't know how this case ends because I only heard the first part.
Yeah. So that's like what's really interesting about the case that you guys are about to hear is that the first part, Morgan and I recorded that a week ago. With Egg Theory. So we recorded it technically 8 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll let you guys know when the second part begins and ends because obviously like it's going to be a little different, like the tone of what we're talking. I originally wrote it to be two separate episodes, part one, part two. And now it's one thing. So
AKA, we got yelled at for our AKAs. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Look, I like just saying AKA.
Just like, I know it means also known as, but I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, I really like saying
it's
it.
It's just, it's like, okay, what else am I going to say other than that?
Or like, so then, like AKA, I don't have a segment.
Yeah.
Even though I know that means also known as, like it's going to work right now. So today, this episode, I don't have a segment.
But like technically when you say also known as, I guess like when we use it incorrectly is when I'll be like, so they said this, this, and this, AKA they didn't give a fuck. So then it would be like also known as they didn't give a fuck. But I feel like that still kind of works.
Yeah. I mean, we have taken the phrase AKA, AKA and have created our own.
Can we create like our own version of AKA that's not saying AKA? Like what if we just said like CNC?
CAC.
Yeah, CAC.
I don't like it.
Me either. It's going to have to be something like a
MNT.
I guess we could say, or you could say. Okay, but we could shorten that.
O-Y-C-S.
O-Y-C-S. O-Y-C-S. I'm going to start saying that.
O-Y-C-S.
O-Y-C-S.
I don't have a segment today.
Like, I don't even know what else we would fill that with.
AKA is like iconic. No, that doesn't work.
But we can't use that. Iconic, but chaotic.
IBC.
IBC. Isn't a brand of beer or something?
IBC root beer.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my younger cousin, he would always at the beach, like he was funny, hilarious kid. And he would always say, somebody get me an IBC, referring to the root beer.
An IBC.
Somebody get me an IBC.
Specific, not the other brands.
No, he only drank
specifically,
IBC.
He needs an IBC.
Glass bottle.
I mean, fair enough.
He was probably 8 years old.
I will tell you that root beer, I wouldn't pick root beer to drink from a fountain, from like anywhere. I will drink root beer in a float and I will root beer In a bottle.
But
that's it. Like, I don't want it over ice. Like, I want it to be a frosted bottle.
I like it over ice.
A little freezer burnt.
What's your favorite soda?
Soda pop. Like an old diner soda?
Yeah.
I love like orange and grape crush.
Do you?
Yeah.
I knew you were going to say that.
Crush, so not Fanta. I don't like Fanta.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I'll drink a fucking Fanta. I will also drink a fucking root beer. I'm not going to be like, I'm not drinking that. But I would, if I'm asking for it, I'm asking for it to be in a glass bottle that's like freezer burnt.
Yeah, if you had to get a glass bottle of any soda, you would pick.
What is the situation?
We're sitting down at a diner and you just ordered a cheeseburger with.
With Tots.
Tots. I was going to go curly, but yeah, Tots.
No, I want Tots.
Okay.
On my diner. It was called The Spot in Cleveland. And
so you have your Tots, you have your burger.
I'm getting my orange or my grape crush.
Really?
Yeah. Always.
I'll get a root beer.
My parents don't like root beer at all. And so I really only ever had root beer when I was at like my friends' houses and shit. And I was just always like, fuck, this thing is so sweet.
You know what we always had in the house?
What?
I can't even say it.
Yeah, to say it.
Mountain Dew.
Yeah, I have.
My older brother was like, Mountain Dew or die.
I had that phase. I also had a Dr. Pepper addiction phase.
Me too.
Yep.
Maybe Mellow it's just Yellow.
Like a little mini. Oh, fuck. I was a Mellow. That was my drink when I was little. That was like the first soda I ever tried.
I wonder what the first. I bet it was a Mountain Dew. Like almost like 100%. Like,
yeah.
I could, if I had to take a guess, I would say it was, my first soda was a Mountain Dew.
Do you know what your first word was?
Probably fuck. I mean, I don't know. Probably fuck.
I was not prepared. I was not ready.
This is why I should have drank Red Bull before I record.
Oh, I fucking love Red Bull. I wish I had a fucking Red Bull.
Oh my God. Okay, what was your first word?
Bird.
Bird?
You're crying.
I know. Food.
Yeah, like I didn't say mom or dad or anything normal. I was like, bird.
I'm so curious. I'm going to have to ask I'm going to text my mom and then maybe by the end. No.
No.
I'll hit you guys next week.
Yeah.
I'll let you know what my first word was next week.
Oh. Okay, guys.
If you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up.
And let's get creepy.
All right, y'all. We are in the thick of summer.
We're in the heat of it.
The heat.
It is hot.
It is so hot. My AC unit cannot keep up.
You are sweating. We know you're not eating enough because you're going home in the AC and all you want to do is lay around and nap and grab whatever's closest to you, which is probably a bag of chips.
If you're me. 100%.
Yeah, that's what I do.
And I also lay on the cold tile in the kitchen while I eat my bag
trying
of chips.
To cool down.
100%. So you're probably looking for some wholesome, convenient meals to support these sunny, active days. Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, can help you fuel up fast with flavorful and nutritious ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save time, eat well, and stay on track reaching your summer goals.
Or maybe your summer schedule makes you really, really busy and you're just too busy running around during the day to even think about lunch. Keep your energy up with Lunch to Go. It's effortless, wholesome meals like grain bowls and salad toppers that are ready to eat when you're on the go, and there's no microwave required.
Or maybe you're out on some adventures. So stick to your wellness goals with premium ready-to-go meals featuring high-quality ingredients such as broccolini, leeks, and asparagus. Treat yourself to 34-plus weekly restaurant-quality options like bruschetta shrimp risotto, green goddess chicken, and grilled steakhouse filet mignon, ready in just 2 minutes.
This July, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered to your door. No prep and no mess.
Head to factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 and use code creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off.
That's code creepsandcrimes50 at factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off.
This is Amanda Hirsch from the Not Skinny But Not Fat podcast. You might know me from Not Skinny But Not Fat on Instagram, where I spend my time talking about reality TV, celebrities, everything happening in pop culture every Tuesday, okay? I also talk to some of our favorite celebs and reality TV stars. We talk about what's going on. Tune in every Tuesday and just feel like you're talking with your best friends in your living room.
Okay, so the case I have for you guys today, you of course have seen it on the title, is the Girl Scout murders in Oklahoma from 1977. Before I jump into this, I want to let you guys know that this case does involve rape, sexual assault, abuse, sodomy, murder of three young girls. It is a very, very, very hard case to hear, and I don't think it's right for everyone. I just think that you guys should be in the right mental space to take this. This case is very complex and a bit controversial, especially within like the true crime community. Most creators do not want to cover this case because of all of the backlash that you can get if you take a firm stance in either position. That's why I held off for as long as I have on covering this case. But I think I'm at a place with it now because it's been a case I've had on my list for over a year at this point. I am confident in my research and I'm confident of the maturity that we are, that we can like have these conversations. And I'm also confident that the people that are listening will be able to be understanding when we have the conversation and we discuss the case from the two different sides. Now, this concerns racism towards Native American individuals and communities. The reason I'm doing it the way that I'm doing it and how I'm covering it is because I want to be very, very, very respectful of the Indigenous Native American communities that this case is intertwined with. And I also want to be extremely respectful and very well spoken for the sake of the victims and their families, which is lines I don't want to blur because I know what my intention is behind my words and you could perceive it completely differently. But I wanted to go ahead and make you guys aware of this prior to getting into the case. We're going to jump into it now. So trigger warnings and just making it clear with you guys that I'm telling this case from a very third person point of view with no bias other than these babies deserve justice and someone who stands firmly with Native American Indigenous communities in the repeated trauma and abuse that they face at the hands of the white man law.
Okay. I mean, I know nothing about this case. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's...
So I just got a quick gist though.
It was the summer of 1977 in Mays County, Oklahoma, with the nearby town of Locust Grove. Camp Scott was gearing up to take on hundreds of Girl Scouts as they did each year since opening in 1928, making this summer the 49th year of hosting the Tulsa-based Magic Empire Girl Scouts Council. The camp sat on 410 acres owned by the Tulsa Scout Council, occupying the space between Snake Creek and Spring Creek, just off of Highway 82 in the center of very dense forest. There were a total of 20 buildings on the property when it opened that surprisingly had running water and plumbing. At Camp Scott, Girl Scouts would practice their skills such as swimming, pathfinding, archery, bridge building, insect life, bird studying, CPR training, and leadership skills, along with many other things. This was the place to be each summer, and they hit a record in 1957 with 4,606 girls attending camp.
Wow.
Just that summer.
That's a lot.
For the purpose of this case, I want to be sure that you all have a very good understanding about the layout of Camp Scott. It is an extremely hard place to describe in words. So I put maps for you guys to follow on our Instagram on the episode announcement. First, it is very important to note that this is a very, very, very remote area. It is surrounded in crazy dense wood. Like you can't even like see what's 20 feet in front of you because of how dense and green this area is.
Perfect Bigfoot woods is what you're
perfect
saying.
Perfect Bigfoot woods. They were so incredibly thick that something was just 20 yards away you could not see at all.
Mm-hmm.
ultimately at Camp Scott, there were various units or mini camps within Camp Scott itself. And they were all named after Native American tribes, with 8 to 10 tents at each of these units or mini camps. I'm going to refer to them as units as we continue on. Each of them also having their own outdoor toilets or latrines and a campfire. And I posted this photo for you guys, and I'm going to show you, Morgan. So like, here's one unit, here's one unit.
And each unit had 10 tents.
8 to 10 tents.
Okay.
Yeah. These tents all sat on wooden platforms that were covered by a canvas where the four sides could either be secured down or rolled up. And inside sat four cots, which would serve as the home for the campers over the next 2 weeks while they were at camp. This was a coming of age sort of summer experience for the young girls. Therefore, their tents were their responsibilities. Each unit had a designated counselor's tent where they would sleep. However, no counselors would be staying in the individual tents with the other girls. Did that make sense?
So the girls were by themselves.
The girls were by themselves in their individual tents, but each unit or mini camp had a counselor's tent with like 3 to 4 counselors inside.
Okay.
This was an extremely large camp that was made to house hundreds and hundreds of campers at a time and provide many outdoor activities and trainings. All of the counselors were women that had spent basically every single summer since the age of 9 in the shoes of their campers doing these activities, and now they looked after their campers. Mm-hmm. It was very personal. It is a generational thing and so very important for these women and girls. It was a safe space to empower, educate, make lifelong friendships, and share wisdom woman to woman, girl to girl. On Sunday, June 12th, 1977, excited, loaded down with all of their camping bags and gear, and hugging their parents goodbye, almost 140 Girl Scouts sang and squealed and talked as they waved out the buses to their families, pulling out of the Tulsa Girl Scout headquarters, headed for Camp Scott. Of these girls were 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Heather Goose, and 10-year-old Doris or Denise Milner. She went by Denise, which is what I'm going to be referring to her as throughout this entire case. That year, 15-year-old Michelle Hoffman was promoted from a camper to a counselor at Camp Scott. And for the sake of not confusing the names, because we have two Michelles in this story, I'm going to be referring to her strictly as Hoffman. Before loading the buses at the Tulsa Girl Scout headquarters, Hoffman spotted Denise Milner standing closely to her mother, Betty, clearly very nervous to go to camp. Denise was one of the only, if not the only, African-American girls going on the trip this year. Hoping to make her feel more comfortable and confident, Hoffman walked over to Denise and Betty and introduced herself. Betty told her that Denise was feeling a little bit homesick already and not wanting to go to Camp Scott. Denise was a straight-A student who was originally so excited for this adventure at summer camp with her best friends that she had planned to go with, but at the very last minute, all of her friends backed out. And Denise wanted to, too. Hoffman reassured her through many, many stories of all of her summers spent at this camp, filled with mentions of all of the new friends that she had made throughout the way, and offered Denise, like, hey, I'll take you under my wing. You can sit with me on the bus. Like, I'll be your friend. She then promised Betty that she would look after Denise and let her call home if she wasn't enjoying herself by the end of day two. After saying goodbye to Betty, Denise nervously boarded the bus with Hoffman, chatting and singing songs as they turned down Cookie Trail to the camp's entrance. Hoffman then escorted Denise to her tent. It was at the Kiowa unit, tent number 8 or number 7, depending on the map or the reportings that you're looking through. There, Denise was introduced to Lori Lee Farmer and Michelle Goose, her tent mates. The reason that the tent numbers differ is because technically it was tent number 8. However, tent number 1 was the counselor's tent. So the counselors for this trip only put the numbers on the camper's tent. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So like,
but on the map, counselor's tent is number 1.
Counselor's tent is number 1. Theirs would be number 8. So for my reportings, because of this, I'm going to refer to Denise, Lori Lee, and Michelle's tent as tent number 8 and the counselor's tent as tent number 1 to avoid any confusion when you look at the maps that I'm posting on Insta, because for the most part, they all say 1 through 8. Essentially, Kiowa had 8 tents total, and tent number 8 was the furthest away from tent number 1, or the counselor's tent, but the closest to the toilets. And I'm going to show you a picture of this. Counselor's tent, tent number 8, campfire, okay. Latrine, or toilet.
Okay.
On
so the it's like a big half arch.
Yeah.
Half moon.
Exactly. So on the map, it is very clear that the Kiowa unit was by far one of the most or more remote units at the camp. And I'm going to refer you back to map number 1. Here is Kiowa. The only other one that's out there is this one.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else has like a buddy beside them.
Right.
And they're also right beside the front, one of the back gates. Very, very remote. And for the 1977 annual Girl Scout camp, the Kiowa unit would be housing 27 Girl Scouts and only three counselors. So Hoffman introduced Denise to Lori Lee and Michelle, saying her goodbyes and leaving the girls to get to know each other. The girls did not know each other prior to this interaction, but they quickly became close friends, according to a letter that Lori Lee wrote home to her family that night. She, Lori Lee, at 8 years old, was the youngest of the three and the youngest at the entire camp as a whole. Lori was extremely mature for her age. She was an avid reader. And like before heading off to Camp Scott, she was like telling her parents, hey, I gotta finish my book, Where the Red Fern Grows. Very, very, very avid reader. She was extremely mature to her age, probably the result of being the oldest of five girls belonging to her parents, Beau and Sherry Farmer. However, Lori knew how to have a good time. She was a little shy at first, but she was bright and very playful and imaginative. She was so excited for camp, and she wrote her family about how much fun she was having with her two new best friends. Michelle was a very quiet 9-year-old girl, described by her family as shy but excited for her second year at the camp, only requesting that while she was gone, her mother would look after her plants. She loved being outdoors, and she is described as very athletic and a girl that just loved being active, making camp the highlight of her summers. Day one of the camp was a beautiful day. Everyone got settled in their tents, were shown around the camp, introduced to their tent mates, their counselors, and the other girls within their unit, and the fun was just about to begin. At some point during dinner, though, a massive storm blew in. It was raining so bad and so hard that after dinner, they were actually unable to take the girls out onto the singing porch for song hour. So instead, they decided to just sing within the dining hall. The voices of over 140 girls and women echoed through the campsite, masking the sound of the storm and the rain. Finally, when the rain let up enough, all of the girls were then taken back to their units. Though they were very sad to have missed their first campfire that took place every single night of the camp and very anxious to see who would be the first keeper of the ashes, the girls were more than excited to write home to their families and hang out with their new tent mates as they got ready for bed, closing out their first night at camp.
So what's the keeper of ashes?
So the keeper of ashes, at the end of every single bonfire that they would have, one girl of the scouts would be chosen to take a jar and scoop up the ashes. And she would hold those ashes from the first night of camp. And the next night, someone else would be chosen.
And what do they have to do to get chosen? Do you know?
I'm not really sure, but I know it was like a huge honor to be able to do that.
Like camper of the day or something. Exactly. Is really what it was.
Exactly. Okay. Because of the storm and just how remote this camp was, many of the girls and counselors were astonished at just how dark the night was. One camper actually wrote home to her parents that she could not tell the difference between her eyes being open or closed when there were no lanterns or lights on.
Okay. Dark.
Dark, dark. According to Lori Lee Farmer's letter home, she, Denise, and Michelle had finished up their letters and were getting ready to go to bed at approximately 7:45 p.m. At approximately 10 p.m., Kiowa counselor Dee Elder did a tent check. She told all the girls that it was like time to go to bed, lights out. At which point, Lori Lee, Denise, and Michelle were awake and chatting, but they followed Dee's directions and turned off all of their lights and quietly tucked themselves into bed. Approximately 30 minutes to an hour after this, before going to sleep herself, Hoffman, Michelle Hoffman, wanted to check in on Denise as she had promised her mom, Betty. She made her way to the Kiowa unit tent number 8. However, when she got there, all of the girls were already asleep, resting up for their second day of camp. The counselors then got settled into their tents, turned off their lights, and everyone needed to rest up because the second day of camp was technically the first full day of activities. But that did not stop girls throughout the camp at every single unit in their tents from staying up all night long, just giggling, chatting, and talking. Very girly things. Causing camp counselors in each unit to have to get up every few fucking minutes to go quiet them down. Between 8 and 10 p.m. on June 12th, 1977, the night, a counselor from the Comanche unit spotted a dim amber light moving throughout the woods. And this light looked as if it was walking towards the Kiowa unit. And she just assumed that it was maybe a counselor preparing for lights out and just checking the area and went to bed. 2 hours later, at midnight, Kiowa counselor Carla Wilhite heard campers laughing and making noises in the area of the toilets or the latrine, which is located, like I said, closest to tent number 8. She gets up, she goes over to the girls, she talks to them, and she's like, let's go back to your tent, takes them back there, drops them off, and it was like, go to bed. She goes back to her tent, number one, goes to sleep. 1:30 a.m., which is now the early morning hours of Monday, June 13th, 1977, another unit's counselor that was getting up to get onto like a tent of girls that were up laughing and being very loud, noticed a dim light in the woods moving around at the Kiowa camp. Again, she assumes that it was a camper either going to the bathroom or a counselor checking on something, and she returned to bed herself. Sometime around or after 2 to 3 a.m., Carla from the Kiowa camp counselor is awoken again. But this time it's not by girls laughing or talking. It's a very odd sound that she said that she's never heard before or since. She sits up quietly and just begins carefully listening, and the sound continued. She described it as a low guttural sound coming from the woods behind her tent, counselor tent number one, and camper tent number two. This was something that she couldn't quite make out or like put a name or a match to. So she gets out of bed to go investigate the dense forest surrounding her, using just a flashlight, moving it around, trying to spot the source of the sound. She continued walking further and further into the woods, getting closer and closer with every step to that sound. But at some point, every time she would take a step forward, the sound would stop. She would sit there for a little bit, hear no noises, and then begin backing away, and the sound would start again. She played this forward and backwards game for a few minutes before she began getting this uneasy feeling. She started thinking like something, if this was an animal, which is what she, the only thing that she could write it off as being, if this was an animal, it could pounce at her at any second. So she got scared and she decided to go back to her tent and just go to sleep. Needless to say, it was a very long night for the camp counselors, but they had to power through because day two was just hours away from commencing. Monday, June 13th, 1977 was an early morning for Carla Wilhite. Despite her very much sleepless night, when her alarm went off at 6 a.m., she grabbed her glasses, her towel, toiletry bag, her clothes for the day, and began walking to the shower house. To get to the showers from the Kiowa camp, you had to walk down a short trail to the main road and then across the main road to another path that would take you to the center of the camp. As Carla is walking across the main road from the short path that took her from the unit, something catches her eye to her right. On the side of the road, Carla sees sleeping bags piled up near the base of a tree. And her first thought was like maybe they had gotten wet during the storm that happened in dinner. The girls had hung them out to dry overnight and they were eventually blown away by the wind. Carla's like, I've got to go get these, hang them up so the girls can have something to sleep in tonight. So she starts walking closer. But that's when she saw what was behind the sleeping bags. Lying partially in the road and partially in the woods was the lifeless body of a young girl. She was nude from the waist down with dried blood on her forehead from a very apparent head injury with her eyes wide open. Immediately trying to rationalize what she was seeing, Carla's mind just started racing. Maybe the little girl had slept, walked, or ran in the middle of the night, or maybe even gotten scared, jarred awake, confused and not knowing where she was. Maybe she just started running, thinking that it was a nightmare, and eventually ran into a tree, dying from her injuries, alone in the woods. This all flashed across Carla's mind in a matter of seconds before she began sprinting back to her tent, shaking Dee and the other counselor for the Kiowa unit awake, quiet but frantically and sternly telling them to wake up because there was a dead camper on the road and they needed a head count of their unit immediately. They jumped out of the bed and individually walked into the tents, placing their hands directly on the heads of each of the campers. Within minutes of this discovery, Dee ran to Carla. They were missing three girls from tent number eight. 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Heather Goose, and 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner. Before Dee could even finish her sentence explaining what she found in tent number eight, Carla was sprinting as fast as she could to the camp director's cabin. In interviews, she described this moment and how all she could think to do was just run like hell through those woods to get help. She busted into the director's cabin, whose husband had happened to stay the night after fixing everything the first night, and he was an ER doctor or nurse. The reports differ. Before Carla could even finish explaining what she found and what happened, he bolted past her and out the door, sprinting to the location that the little girl was discovered. Carla and the director quickly woke up the camp nurse and rushed to the scene behind him. When they got to him at the scene, he turned around with a sunken face. He had discovered the bodies of two other girls. They were crumpled down at the bottom of those two sleeping bags that she saw piled up.
God.
Dead. But this was no freak accident, as Carla had originally tried to rationalize. He knew by just looking at them, they had been brutally murdered. At this point, Dee had met up with all of them on the trail, who was the other counselor at Kiowa Unit. There, she was finally able to explain what she found in tent number 8, blood. Large pools of it. By 7 a.m., police had flooded the camp along with agents from the OSBI, which is the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. The campers from the Kiowa unit and others that were close by this unit had been woken up and told that as a punishment for keeping the counselors up all night, they would be going on a morning hike through the woods behind the unit around the outside of the camp before walking back through the center of camp. But in reality, this was in order to keep them from seeing the crime scene and keeping the unit untouched and the girls away. The director arranged buses to immediately pick up the other campers and take them back to the Tulsa Girl Scout headquarters and reunited with their families. News spread like wildfire, though, through Tulsa and the surrounding areas, with every single news station, newspaper, journalist, and reporter covering the case from the outside of Camp Scott's gates. All that was known was that three girls were found dead, but that was it. No one knew anything else for that entire first day. Parents had no idea if it was their daughters and eagerly waited for hours outside of the headquarters of the Girl Scouts in Tulsa until the buses finally arrived at 2:15 that afternoon. Some say not knowing is the worst, but I think it could be argued that knowing it was your daughter is actually the worst. That morning, Dr. Bo Farmer, 8-year-old Lori Lee's father, was finishing up his night shift as an ER doctor when he was paged to the nurse's station to answer a call. On the other line was the executive director of the Girl Scout Council, who took a deep breath before telling a parent the unthinkable. "Your daughter, Lori Lee, was found dead outside of her tent this morning." In Keeper of the Ashes, which is the Hulu documentary covering this entire case, Dr. Bo explained that he essentially blacked out after hearing those words. The next thing that he could remember was his partner grabbing his shoulder and telling him that he was going to be driving him home to his wife, Lori's mother, Sherry. Sherry described the moment that she saw her husband and his partner walking through the front door. Her stomach sank, knowing that whatever it was they were about to tell her was going to be life-changing. They told her that she needed to sit, but she couldn't. She needed to know right then. They argued back and forth, begging her to sit, but she refused. Before it was said, her oldest daughter was dead. Betty, Denise's mother, was working as a school nurse at the time when she was called to the front desk. There, she was told the news. She was absolutely numb, just words you cannot imagine hearing. But she knew that she needed direction. All she could say was, "What do I do next?" They gave her the medical examiner's number and told her that Denise would be taken to his office for an autopsy, and that would be her next step. Now, I'm going to walk us through the autopsies and the crime scene, explaining what investigators believed happened to Denise, Lori, and Michelle. This is going to be so hard to report, but like even harder to hear. So I'm going to give you a massive trigger warning for rape, sexual assault, sodomy, details, violence, and much more, all of a child. Skip forward if you need to, and I'm going to try my best to remember to place the timestamps in our show description so you can be aware of when the worst is over. But if I'm going to be completely frank with you, this is one of those cases where I just don't know if it can get any better. All right. Found inside of the sleeping bags, crumpled at the bottom, were 9-year-old Michelle and 8-year-old Lori Lee. Found lying on top of her sleeping bag, halfway in the road, halfway in the woods, was 10-year-old Denise. The girls had been tied up using cords and rope, with their hands bound behind their backs. Two of them were raped, and one of them was sodomized. The crime scene suggests that their killer had entered tent number 8 through the rear and attacked the girls while they were sleeping. The crime scene and autopsies also suggest that both Michelle and Lori were killed in the tent as a result of blunt force trauma to their heads. Their bodies were then placed into their sleeping bags, zipped up, thrown over the shoulders of their attacker or attackers, and carried 150 feet across the Kiowa unit campsite to the location that they were found. This was determined because of smeared blood stains about 5 foot 8 inches from the base of a wooden stake at the front entrance of tent number 8. However, it is unclear if that was the exact location that their attacker planned on placing them because of Denise's autopsy findings. According to the county coroner, though Denise did suffer from blunt force trauma to her head, it was not her cause of death. Instead, she was sexually assaulted and strangled by her attacker at the location that her body was discovered. It was evident that their killer had attempted to cover his tracks by using mattress covers and towels to wipe up the blood. But at the tent, also investigators found a semen sample on one of the pillows and two bloody footprints, one inside the tent and one outside. Oddly enough, though, they were two different shoe prints. Near the location that the girls' bodies were discovered, investigators found a crowbar, a nylon rope, a pair of girls' seeing glasses, and most importantly, a red flashlight beside Denise's body. This flashlight had been modified. It had a black trash bag duct taped around its lens with a small hole made in the center of it. This would essentially allow the flashlight to give just enough light that the attacker could see where they were going, but not enough light to be seen far off in the distance. After examining this flashlight, investigators also found a smeared bloody fingerprint on the lens. Unfortunately, though, it was only a partial print, which was also exactly what the coroner found all over the girls' bodies. Not a single full print was found. Using the evidence found at the scene, the temperatures of the girls' bodies at the time they were discovered, and the interviews from campers and counselors, investigators were able to piece together a timeline of this crime. I know that we have walked through what Carla and others had experienced throughout the night, specifically that low guttural sound that she heard. Looking back, knowing what we know now, it can be assumed that what she heard was one of the girls fighting to breathe. But there were two more accounts from that night that I did not mention earlier from other campers at the Kiowa unit. The girls in tent number 7, which is just feet away, the closest tent to tent number 8, spotted a light approaching their tent. They had no idea what time it was or anything like that, but some reports say it was approximately 1 to 2 a.m. Very quickly after noticing this light moving around, a very bright light flooded their entire tent, like blinding them. But once their eyes adjusted, they were able to see a man, a silhouette of a man, standing at the entrance of their tent. He then closed the flaps and left.
Like he was looking for someone.
Right. Like he was looking for a person or something.
Mm-hmm.
And for like him to be so bold.
Right.
Entering that.
You know? That to me, like a big flash of light sounds like a scan, like a search. Like,
exactly.
Wrong one. Close it.
And like, how do you go from entering the rear of the tent to the front entrance, you know? Mm-hmm. An hour or so later, at approximately 3 a.m., two girls in two separate tents, a girl in tent 6 and a girl in tent 7, were woken up by the sound of a girl screaming. One of the girls sat up and began listening for another sound when she heard a girl crying softly before she said, "Mama, mama."
Oh,
God. The girls that heard this were too scared to run to a counselor because the tent was on the other fucking side and they didn't know what to do. So they just went back to sleep. Investigators then interviewed all of the residents surrounding Camp Scott, and one man whose property is closest to the Kiowa unit reported hearing quite a bit of traffic on the remote road that separates the woods from Camp Scott, which is where the girls' unit was, his property, between 2:30 and 3 a.m. Next, the camp director's husband reported to the coroner. When he got to the girls' bodies and checked for a pulse, both Michelle and Lori were cold to the touch, whereas Denise was still very warm. This was also confirmed by the autopsy. What this indicates is that there is a very large gap of time between their times of death, supporting the theory that while being carried by her killer, likely unconscious because of the blunt force trauma to the head, Denise woke up and he realized that she had survived. Instead of choosing to kill Denise immediately, he continued to assault her. Investigators noted that the only thing that was truly left behind by the attacker or attackers were the items near the girls' bodies. Specifically, that red flashlight stood out as the biggest indicator that he or they left in a massive rush. But why? This crime was planned out. It was not a spur of the moment type of crime. This attacker knew what they were doing. Everything else about this crime was incredibly meticulous mm-hmm. and planned out. What caught them so off guard, it forced them to leave in such a hurry, leaving behind tons and tons of evidence. Carla.
In the woods.
It was not when she heard that sound and investigated it, because that would be too short of a time between the girls' deaths.
Oh my God.
It made it to where Denise would not be warm. It was her 6 a.m. alarm.
Oh my God.
The attacker must have heard her alarm and had just enough time before she walked by him to strangle Denise and run and hide before getting away in the time frame that Carla went to get the other counselors and director. So their time of deaths and the time of this crime is placed between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m.
My God.
After searching the crime scene and collecting as much evidence as possible, interviewing and interrogating all the counselors, adults at the camp, and surrounding residents, investigators were confident to clear all of these people that they had questioned. Meaning, this was someone that came into the camp and was likely still in the surrounding woods. They needed to search the surrounding area, and they needed to do this fast. Teams of agents from OSBI and officers from various law enforcement offices and agencies were sent out on foot with helicopter teams working in the skies. But the thing about this area is that it is extremely remote, old, and mostly abandoned. There are countless old buildings, barns, and cellars sprinkled throughout this mountainous, densely forested terrain that is home to a number of cave systems and caverns. This person could be hiding anywhere, especially if they knew the area well. OSBI agent Harvey Pratt knew this area well and was the leader of one of the search teams. He and his team began searching all of the caves and cellars in their assigned area when they came across a cellar of an old home that is often described as a cave. Sitting at the entrance of this cave were four little fires. Agent Pratt knew what these were. They were sacred native fires, as he is of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. Pratt and his team then entered the cave, where they found a pair of sunglasses that was later to be confirmed belonging to one of the camp counselors and stolen that night, a roll of duct tape that was later confirmed to be an exact match to the duct tape found on that red flashlight, and then two torn photographs from a wedding. After piecing the photographs together, no one recognized these people captured in the photos, so they needed the public's help. They ran these photos on the news and in every single paper that went out the following day. Within minutes, tips flooded in, which is how they got their first lead, the first actual suspect in the case, a name that everyone in Mays County, including the sheriff, Pete Weaver, knew all too well, Gene Leroy Hart. And so one of the largest and most dangerous manhunts in Oklahoma history commenced. Okay, guys, so this is now where you're entering part two, just to make you guys well known about it. And this is where we're going to be getting into a lot of less gruesome detail until the end, which I'm going to warn you about, but a lot more, I don't want to say like controversial. It's just going to be like, I want you to understand prior to me getting into this that I'm going to be showing you multiple points of view, even the ones that I don't agree with, or the ones that are different than what my personal views are about this case. I mean, you guys always know where I land and everything. We've made it very fucking clear. Like, you know,
you can read us like a book.
You know where we're going to stand with it. But it's just, I want to make sure that I get to give each piece of this and everyone's perspective and experience their own spotlight in it. So here we go. According to Brooke Withrow's reporting in an article from KOCO News 5, Gene Leroy Hart was born in Claremore, Oklahoma on November 27, 1943, and is of Cherokee descent. He was raised by his mother primarily due to having hardly a relationship to his father his entire life. Growing up, he was considered to be an outstanding member of society and a hometown hero. In high school at Locust Grove, he was a football star and was even offered multiple scholarships to play at the collegiate level in the late 50s. However, Hart chose not to continue his education or football career and instead decided that he was going to get a job right out of high school at Tulsa Flint Steel. He got married to his sweetheart and they settled down. Soon after, Hart and his wife had a child, but their marriage was barely holding on. By the mid-60s, when Hart was only in his early 20s, they divorced, and this is the point that Hart changed as a person. Before I get into this, guys, I'm going to be describing a crime against two pregnant women that involves RSA, abuse, torture, bondage, and captivity. It should only be a minute that you have to skip if you'd like to skip through this. In June of 1966, 22-year-old Hart was at a Tulsa nightclub when he abducted two young pregnant women in the parking lot. He drove the women deep into the forest of Mays County, which is where he lived at the time and where Camp Scott is, and brutally raped and sodomized both of the women. they were each wearing prescription glasses, like seeing glasses, and he would take them off during the attack and wear them. He had glasses himself, and he would say like he was just testing out the prescription. He then left the women in the woods, bound, gagged, and taped to tree stumps on a rocky hillside and just fled. Somehow, the women survived their attack and were able to break free and ran for help, still in their bindings.
Wow. The women, some strong mamas.
Really, though. The women gave the make and model of the car that they were forced into, the first four digits of the license plate of the car that they were forced into, and a detailed description of their attacker. When shown a photo of Jean Leroy Hart, the women confirmed with certainty that he was 100% the man that had done this to them, and it was his car and license plate. Hart was arrested. He admitted to it when he was arrested, charged, and later convicted, and he pled guilty to two counts of rape and kidnapping, for which he was sentenced to 3 10-year prison terms to be served concurrently or simultaneously. Simultaneously would mean...
at the same time.
So, like, you're just serving...
10 years.
10 years.
For right. 3 charges.
Because of this concurrent little fine print, I guess.
Right.
He was paroled after 28 months.
That's it?
That's it. Within 24 hours, he committed one burglary, and then within the week, he had committed 4. I'm really unsure about which one he was later charged with or which ones. I know eventually he was charged with all 3 to 4, but differing reports on this. Anyways, within that week, the last person, the fourth person that he went into the home in the middle of the night and stole a bunch of shit walking around their house was a police officer's home during which he was caught and arrested. So in early 1973, this is when he was caught and arrested. He gets returned to Mays County Jail because he did this on fucking parole, and he's having to have a hearing for this charge and basically figure out what happens because he did this when he was on parole. At this point, at this relief hearing, he's facing up to 350 years.
Wow.
In prison. Well, as this is going on, of course, he's being held at the Mays County Jail, awaiting for his hearing and the trial to go through. And he escapes.
So he's Ted Bundy Jr.
Within a day, they find him and they bring him back. During his time incarcerated at Mays County Jail, he worked for the jail's photo lab for the prison photographer. And this prison photographer, like, also did weddings on the side.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, what?
Imagine hiring that.
Right.
$4,000 just for the prison photographer
to come in here. So the prison photographer, like, he had this photo lab where...
he wasn't in prison, right?
Yeah, the photo lab was in the prison. He wasn't, like, incarcerated.
Right,
he worked for the police department. Okay. And I guess they have a photographer for yearbooks? I don't really know.
Interesting.
That's really interesting. Anyways, they have this prison photographer.
Like mugshot?
Maybe. And he's got like this lab in there. And so he would like pick assistants to come and work with him in the lab. And Jean Leroy Hart was one of these people. So not only was he doing the prison photos, but the wedding photos as well. This is important because those photos that were found in that cave/cellar thing, which connected Hart to the cave, therefore connecting him to the murders of the Girl Scouts, were from a wedding that the photographer had shot and developed during the time that Hart worked for him.
So they're all looking, scouring around, looking for who's this couple in this photograph. And It's just these two innocent people that had hired a prison photographer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's unlucky.
Unlucky. Now, you're probably wondering at what point that he got released again in order to commit these murders and for these photos from this wedding to be out in the middle of the world that could connect him to this woods. Well, he didn't get released. He escaped again on September 16th, 1973, using something that was smuggled to him in a Bible by a family member. And ever since September of 1973, he had been on the run. Just learning that Jean Leroy Hart was potentially their guy sent shivers down investigators' spines, because this was not someone that they could find easily. He's been on the run for 5 years at this point. He could live off the land. He had connections to people that lived off the grid in this area. This is where he was raised. And he was used to hiding from law enforcement and being protected by those people in this area. And he'd been doing it for 5 fucking years. Successfully.
Right.
In fact, that cellar where all of this was found, the sunglasses, the 4 sacred fires, the duct tape, the photos, that was actually the remains of his childhood home.
So So wait, it was a cellar?
That cave.
Okay.
They refer to it as a cave.
But it was a...
But it's technically like a cellar from a house that was built into...
The mountainside.
The mountainside.
Wow, okay.
In the forest. That was his fucking childhood home.
Damn.
And his mother...
He's really been home the whole time.
Exactly. And his mother was currently, at the time of the Girl Scout murders, living just on the other side of the mountain that sat beside Camp Scott.
Okay.
On June 23rd, 1977, just 10 days after the murders took place, police publicly named 33-year-old Jean Leroy Hart as their main suspect. The manhunt that was already underway tripled in size and scale, with residents volunteering, heading out into the forest with their own weapons. It was literally a hunt. Helicopters were brought in from all of the surrounding areas, and the National Guard sent in their infrared search helicopters. Hundreds of FBI agents were sent to join in on this search, and even the best canine units called the Super Dogs in the entire world from Pennsylvania were flown in to try and follow the scent. These two dogs were world-renowned with a 98% accuracy. So police took the dogs and their handlers out to tent number 8 and the location where the girls' bodies were found. Immediately, the dogs picked up on a scent and they started following it. But at the exact same time, the dogs split off, going different directions. Then they started walking in circles. Then they started smelling trees and other areas, still signaling that they had this scent and they were tracking it. Within a few minutes, the dogs were whimpering, they were confused, they were exhausted, they were upset. The scent that they were tracking was everywhere. It was all around this campsite.
Oh my God.
It was something that the dogs had never done before, and their handlers were worried for their lives. Like, these dogs are worth $10,000 each, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, they're the best in the world. They have a 98% accuracy. They've never acted like this. This was so bizarre. The dogs were only there for like 3 days, and then one died of heat exhaustion, and the other one was hit by a car.
Both died?
Yes.
What is going on there?
By October, when the search efforts still had not turned up any viable leads, Mays County Sheriff Pete Weaver was asked when the manhunt would end. I just want to say, on a side note, Sheriff Pete Weaver was going crazy. He was claiming that they found the murder weapon. He was claiming that they found like all these things and was releasing it to the public. And then the DA would come out behind him and be like, no.
We don't know what he's talking about.
No one found that. The OSBI would be like, what the fuck is he talking about? He found the murder weapon. Like, he was losing his shit, but we're going to get into that a little bit more. So they ask him in October, like, hey, when is this manhunt going to end? Is it going to end when you find him, or is there like a cutoff time? And he says, we will stay with it until we find something. We will not stop. Well, two of the state law enforcement offices reported, or agencies reported, that they had spent over $138,000 in the search. Which money, of course, was not a factor at all. It was in the back of everyone's mind, but they just had to report their yearlies.
Mm-hmm.
And that $138,000, it only includes those two, not Mays County or the National Guard. They did all that they could, not even looking at how much it had cost them, but it was just so fruitless at this point that they couldn't
continue
doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they called it off. Sheriff Pete Weaver chimed in to know that this did not mean it was over. They would not stop searching for Hart. Obviously, the tone had changed. To many, this felt like it was no longer about finding evidence or searching for other potential suspects, or really about anything more for Pete Weaver than just finding Jean Leroy Hart. Just like every story, there are multiple sides to it and multiple truths. And before I get into this next part, I need to give a disclaimer that I do not think that Hart is a good person. He is a convicted and admitted rapist. And I'm not saying that he didn't do anything. I'm just going to tell you the other side to this. What we just walked through was the perspective of the media, Tulsa City residents, the Mays County Sheriff's Office, the DA, the Sheriff Pete Weaver. Just to be clear, I'm not referring to the girls' families when I talk about this group. I am talking about the people who actually controlled the narrative of this case. This group of people or organizations had painted Hart as many things, some of which he was, like a rapist, a criminal, an escapee. But they did not just stick to the facts. Instead of calling him what he was, they created a legend out of him and used very racially charged tones and words and propaganda in this case. And this legend they had created to almost dehumanize him further in the eyes of the public, essentially fearmonger.
Right.
They believed that Hart was using, quote, native magic, end quote, to kill those two dogs, confuse them, and keep investigators away. They claimed that he was a Cherokee shapeshifter who could become a bird and would follow them on their searches and mock them. You get the tone.
Right.
Very racist things. I just like don't even feel comfortable going any further into. There was many other things I'm not going to. And the reason I felt okay giving you that little sample that I did is because it actually comes back in the case and kind of gets its power taken back. So we're going to come back to it. Other than this, it was really, really bad. But unfortunately, this was not surprising. There was so much distrust and hatred between the Native American communities in the area and law enforcement at this point in time. Now, because of this case and the narrative that was being pushed about Hart, a lot of Native people were in danger because of this giant manhunt. They were literally arresting young Native men left and right just because they, quote, looked like Hart. Unlawfully searching people's homes and residents, searching for Hart, accusing them that they're hiding him. It was just disgusting.
Right. They're acting like they're not citizens of the United States.
100%. Everyone that knew anyone or anything about Mays County knew that Pete Weaver hated Jean Leroy Hart. He made Weaver look like a fucking dumbass when breaking out of his jail, not once, but twice. And even stayed in Mays County after escaping, just as like a middle finger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not leaving my home. Hart would go out to eat in town. He would drink with his friends. He would hang out. But before anyone could like double take him, be like, is that fucking Hart? He would disappear. Sheriff Pete Weaver had a very public, personal vendetta against Hart for this, which made many wonder if Hart was being framed not only because of Weaver's hatred for him, but because having a Cherokee man or a Native man as a whole at fault for this horrific crime would be politically beneficial for what Oklahoma was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot that just didn't really add up about the cave and the cellar story or how Weaver had even connected Hart to this crime in this cave. Many people from Locust Grove who knew Hart his entire life did not believe that he was capable of killing children and doing this to children. I'm not talking about just a few people either. I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds of white and Native people saying that investigators had the wrong guy.
And they had tunnel vision.
And they're on a warpath.
Native Americans.
Specifically to Pete Weaver just hated fucking Hart.
Yeah.
Hart may be a lot of things, like a rapist, a criminal, an escapee. But those who knew him believed that there was no way he was capable of this. With the official wide-scale manhunt being called off, investigators had to create a new plan of action to try and locate him. As I said prior, he was often hanging out around Mays County, Locust Grove, meaning some people knew where the fuck he was. However, it would not be an easy task to get people to talk. OSBI determined that it would be best to send in two of their agents from the town or with family that lived in the town to try and shake something loose. And they chose Agent Pratt, who we discussed earlier, to be one of the two. Pratt, in his interviews on Keeper of the Ashes, discussed why he was very thankful to be chosen, saying that if he and the other Native agent could get to Hart before Weaver and the Mays County officers, they knew that they would be able to take him in alive. But without saying it directly, he and everyone knew that if it was Weaver or anyone from Mays County, there was going to be a 50-50 shot if he would be taken alive. So Agent Pratt and his partner went into town in streetwear, technically supposed to be undercover, which was what their directions were. But Pratt said there was like really no use in lying. Like you can't gain trust that way. And everyone knows who everyone is. In Locust Grove, they went to this bar that Hart was known to frequent and just began chatting with others there. Everyone, of course, at this point in time is still talking about the Girl Scout murders and this manhunt and everything that's been going on. So it was easy to bring it up in conversation. So they get to talking with this one guy. They bring up the conversation about, what do you think about Hart's possible involvement in this manhunt? He, just like most people in the town, did not believe that he would be capable of doing this. So then Pratt, in a way, baited him by saying something in the ballpark of, yeah, that's what everyone says. And honestly, I feel like most think this way, but why hide instead of just coming out and clearing your name? If someone just knew where he was, that we could just do an interview and question him about it, he could prove his innocence, just serve the rest of his time and get out on parole again, and just go live his life.
Mm-hmm.
The man kind of turned to Pratt and was like, well, I know where he is. He's with the medicine man that's brother recently passed away. So Pratt immediately goes back to the HQ and starts going through all of the obituaries. And he finds Sam Pigeon, a Cherokee medicine man. For those who don't know what exactly a medicine man, medicine woman, medicine people do or are, I want to explain exactly what their roles are. They are traditional healers and spiritual leaders, not to be confused with Native American plant medicine. Cherokee medicine man Arwin Natal explained that, quote, the knowledge possessed by medicine people is privileged and it often remains in a particular family. End quote. However, medicine people and their practices are very different among various tribes. And who is the medicine person or medicine family line is someone in some of these tribes is not known because of just how sacred their practice is.
Okay.
So like they'll wear coverings and no one will actually know who it is because medicine people have supernatural powers that can control spirits and cure illnesses. And I'm using the term medicine man when reading this story, but I do want to note that I am aware that it is a blanket term and not proper terms. I just don't feel like it would be acceptable for me to use the proper and more sacred terms when telling this case. Also, this part of the case is where the quote, native magic shapeshifter story comes back into play. Because so many people in Locust Grove knew that Hart was with Sam, the medicine man, which primarily was Native people that knew this, they truly did wonder if Hart was shape-shifting through Sam to evade arrest long before Lori, Michelle, and Denise were murdered. But what was bad about it was that these white racist people were using it and discussing it in very nasty ways.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, this was a huge deal. They finally knew where Hart was. The only thing left was that they just needed to confirm that he was actually there. So Pratt and his partner drove to Sam's main house the next day where he and his wife lived primarily. And they sat outside watching it for 6 to 7 hours before knocking on the door, still in street clothes. Sam's wife was there, but he was not. Pratt was very open and upfront with her, and he explained that he was with the OSBI and they had received a tip that Hart was staying with Sam. She was very hesitant at first, but then Pratt explained to her the severity of what could follow this interaction. He had to report this lead to his higher-ups, which would then go to Mays County, and they would end up sending agents out there to confirm that Hart was there. If this was the case, Pratt would not have any control about how they take him. However, if she would be willing to trust Pratt and work with him, he promised that he would be able to get Hart arrested peacefully and alive. Whereas if it was someone else, they would probably kill him.
Right. And also probably Sam.
Exactly. She shook her head without really ever saying a word and just got in his car and was like, drive. So they start driving. She's giving them directions, taking them down these like very remote back roads in the deep, deep woods in the mountains, like in the mountains. So they come to this like clearing and she points across like the valley and there sits a cabin. Pratt took her home, dropping her off and thanked her before taking this all back to his supervisors. This was in Cookson Hills, which is an extremely remote area that is known for outlaw-like rules. Think about the Wild Wild West outlaws
mm-hmm.
that we've talked about and you've heard about your entire life, specifically because we've covered them. Bonnie and Clyde is just an example. And know that Cookson Hills is where all of these people would come to party together and kill each other.
Okay.
AKA, it was extremely dangerous for an operation, but even more so than that, for Pratt and other Native agents and officers, there was a different level of danger that they feared. Spiritual warfare could break out if something went wrong during this capture situation. They were walking into a cabin that has been protected and owned by a medicine man's bloodline for years.
Right.
He and others were so concerned that they went to their medicine people to have themselves, their guns, their other weapons, and their bullets cleansed, protected, and blessed.
Wow.
The next day, April 6, 1978, agents and officers surrounded the cabin once Sam Pigeon went to go work at the local tree nursery. In a tactical circular formation, the agents eased in closer to the cabin with two main teams, one that would enter the front door on the front porch and the second that would enter the back door from the back porch. The teams quietly closed in and got into position to enter through the front. As soon as the lead agent busted the door open, a man came running towards them and then quickly turned around, racing towards the back door. When the man came face to face with the back door team, he turned around, starting sprinting towards the front again. Before, he just stopped. He placed his hands in the air and he surrendered. It was Gene Leroy Hart. From what investigators could tell from what they found at the cabin, they concluded that Hart had been living there for many months at this point, but they could not tell exactly how long it was. Now, between his arrest and the actual trial, there was so much shit that went down. Basically, we learned that the Locust Grove DA at the time, named Sid Wise, who was this like bank lawyer businessman that basically got the job as DA because the one before him quit and they needed to fill it fast. He was giving out OSBI classified reports to the press because he had signed a book deal to write about this case once it was all done.
That's corrupt.
This was the nail on the coffin for getting him to take... you're not prosecuting this case, motherfucker.
Right. You're not doing it.
So they basically forced him to ask Buddy Fallis Jr. to come in from Tulsa and assist, but he was the lead prosecutor. The state decided to hold the trial in Pryor, Oklahoma, which is Mays County, Locust Grove, as it was the best shot that they had at getting a fair trial for Hart. Basically, the residents in Locust Grove and Pryor were mainly supporters of Hart, but his only supporters. Anywhere outside of there, it would have not been a fair trial. But this made it a lot more challenging for the prosecution because now they had to work even harder with the limited concrete evidence that they had to get a conviction. And then the jury was selected and not a single Native person was chosen.
Yeah, that was at random for sure. 100%. Right. Yep.
Gene Leroy Hart hired Garvin Isaacs and Gary Pitchlin to represent him as his defense attorneys. Isaacs was an up-and-coming big name, and Gary had worked in advocacy law, but never criminal defense. So essentially, everyone was like, who the fuck
are these
people that he's hiring? Gary had approached Hart to offer their services, as he is Native himself from Oklahoma and went into advocacy law for the Native Nation to represent them in the state of Oklahoma.
Probably because they had very few, if any.
If any. Especially in the 70s at this point in time.
Yeah.
He wanted to be sure that Hart knew exactly what he was up against, the racism that was systematically going to be in the white man's law and how it was not going to be fair to him in general. And he was like, I just want you to know your options. I'm not saying that you need to come and like let us represent you. If you have better people, go with them. But I just wanted you to be aware. Like I said, they were nobody. So when Hart announced that these were going to be his defense attorneys, everyone was so confused because he had gotten offers from the biggest and baddest, most widely known in the nation defense attorneys that were willing to work pro bono for him. And Hart said to Gary and Garvin when they were like, why the fuck did you choose us? Quote, those guys are the big dogs. You only bring them in when you're guilty. I'm not guilty. And you both came highly recommended. End quote.
Whoa.
Bold.
Bold, for sure.
This made the prosecution almost feel like they already had this shit in the bag, but they were so wrong. The trial started on March 9th, 1979. And it was one of the most intense trials to ever take place. I would say in almost history in general, but for sure in Oklahoma history. The prosecution presented their case, which is basically everything I've already told you. The flashlight, the photos, the glasses, et cetera, et cetera. The defense came in with amazing counter arguments for each and every single piece of evidence or accounts or anything that they had against Hart in this trial. But specifically, they came in for the photos, which were the most precious piece of evidence for the prosecution's case. An inmate at Mays County Jail, Alan Little, came forward to testify for the defense. Little testified that for months after Hart escaped, Sheriff Pete Weaver had those two specific photographs at his desk, and he would pull them out anytime Hart got brought up. And he would look at them, he would slam them on the desk, and he would say, I'm going to get that son of a bitch if it's the last thing I do.
Oh, my God.
And many other inmates supported this. Oh,
and
my
these
God.
Are not inmates that are like getting out of prison, getting right. out of jail. These are people that are fucking in there. Like,
and they're pissed.
What else do they have to say?
Yeah,
because I believe that these were the only things that Hart left behind in his cell when he escaped for police to find. So how the fuck, if a month ago,
and that's the only piece of evidence they had,
how did that get in this cave? Okay, now also the glasses that were found in the cave. The photos connected Hart to the cave, right? But the glasses were what connected the cave to the camp. Well, the officers from the scene and allegedly photographers that came in and took crime scene photos said differently. According to many people that were at Camp Scott on the day that the girls were discovered, those specific sunglasses that were found in the cellar slash cave were in the staff house for the photos and the first investigation. It wasn't until day 2 or 3 of the investigation at Camp Scott that the glasses were reported missing by their owner when they brought back the counselors to check around and look through things. And the counselor said that they had been stolen from her purse along with like a few other things. There was a lot of things that were missing from the counselor's tents. All of this to say that the defense was accusing the police of planting evidence and framing Hart, but more specifically, they were accusing P. Weaver of this.
Right.
Overall, the defense was able to simply create doubt around everything that the prosecution brought up. The final piece of this trial that the prosecution saved as their big move was the last thing that they had, and they were banking on it. It was a semen sample. But you have to remember, this is 10 years before DNA even was in the beginning stages of what it is today. So really, there was nothing that they could do other than have someone examine it and compare it to a sample of Hart's semen. But there was no way to definitively say if this was his. March 30th, 1979, the trial's over. The next morning, they get a call. The jury had completed their deliberation. And it was only like, I want to say at most an hour that they had deliberated, which in most cases, if it's fast, it's good for the prosecution. They won. But if it's long, then the defense had at least convinced the jury, some of the jury, that something's off. So March 31st, 1979, the verdict is read. For the 3 counts of first-degree murder of 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Gousset, and 10-year-old Denise Milner, the jury found Jean Leroy Hart not guilty. This was shocking.
Yeah. I bet it tore terror through the town.
I mean, it was a lot.
Because the public at this time, they didn't probably broadcast what was going on in the courthouse. So they have no idea about the photos. The glasses.
This is the first time really that they're, you know, I'm sure like all of the people that were like, no, he fucking did, were like floored. But then right. his supporters, this is the other side of it.
Absolutely.
What this meant was that the supporters finally felt like there was room for justice in the white man's law. Like there was change that was created. Like they were actually able to save him. And typically, if this would have been any other time, no question, he's a convicted criminal. He's going back to jail either way. This wasn't if he was going to jail. He's going back to fucking jail. He's going to prison. He's facing 350 years in prison. It wasn't about that. It was if he did it or not. There's almost no words. And, you know, hearing the point of view of...
It's their first win.
The first win. They've watching the video footage and the interviews, like, there are all these people and they're just sobbing. Mm-hmm. Just sobbing. And they're like, you don't understand how monumental this moment is.
Absolutely.
Not because these little girls haven't received justice yet. It's not about that separately. But I do want to go back to the families. Hearing how they have grown, I don't want to say like the good things that you can take away from something as horrific as this, because there's nothing good that could ever come out of losing such beautiful young girls at the beginning of their life. They compared on the Keeper of the Ashes, and there's many other interviews, and even the People magazine like write up and investigate show about this. In it, you get to see Lori Farmer's parents, who kind of head up all of these documentaries and articles, alongside Betty Milner, Denise's mother, to hear the way that this felt to them then and what it feels like now. Specifically, Sherry, Lori's mom, she talks about how at that point in time, justice would have looked like someone getting the death penalty.
Right.
No matter who the fuck it was, someone's getting held accountable. And at that point in time, it was Jean Leroy Hart. And she said, now it looks a lot different for me. And even Betty talked about how, like, you don't ever want someone to get arrested for something that they didn't do and incarcerated for something that they didn't do. But you're so, it's your baby.
Right.
And at this point, you have to like question yourself. It had been 2 years at this point that this verdict is read. Betty literally said, I had to pinch myself and question myself. Like, was Denise ever really even here at all?
Oh.
That's how distant she felt from her daughter and how dehumanized her daughter felt to her because of having to sit through this fucking trial.
Right. And for as long as it took for them to get to that trial, they were thrown. That Hart was their guy. That Hart killed their baby.
And they're being told that by the people that they're trusting to investigate this. And yet your DA, your sheriff, your sheriff has tunnel vision and has brought everyone in on this manhunt and his own personal vendetta. Even if, let's say that those photos somehow Hart broke back into the jail and stole them or had someone steal them and mail them to him. And that's how he fucking got them. Who fucking knows? Let's say that they weren't planted.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that that was there. We would have been able to say beyond a shadow of a doubt, like, okay, well, if you have these sunglasses that are from the camp and you have this that was from this area, then you did it. But because there was such immediate tunnel vision, and this is law enforcement failed the families of the girls.
Absolutely.
They failed the girls because they let their own...
Specifically sheriff.
But still, like the FBI is brought in on this, the OSBI. Why is no one else saying you've got tunnel vision and all we're doing is trampling and fucking up more potential evidence?
It was driven by race.
Because we're creating a literal hunt. Yes, he was a criminal. Yes, he was a rapist. Yes, he's an escapee. Yes, he's not a good dude. But at the end of the day, if he didn't do it, he didn't do it.
Right.
But then again, like, what are the chances that he was living in this area? Everyone that he was staying with was within a walking, you know, a reasonable walking distance through the woods for someone who had grown up around there and been on the one run in the woods for all that time.
Who's to say that Alan Little didn't go up there and lie on the stand and exactly. have everyone else convinced? Who's to say that?
I think there's enough reasonable doubt on both the defense and the prosecution side, which is why you can't get a guilty verdict.
Mm-hmm.
You can't definitively say anything. But instead of trying to work harder and find more evidence, more concrete evidence, they got such tunnel vision. And you have, and then again, this is another part of it. You have so many offices and agencies at the crime scene that day with journalists and reporters and looky-loos coming up. I mean, beyond. And the photographers were brought in because they needed a wide area to be photographed for evidence. And so they brought in journalists to come in and photograph the bodies and the crime scenes and took the film from them because they just didn't have, they had that one prison photographer and that was it.
Yeah.
And also, who's to say that the prison photographer didn't have it on him? Let's say Jean Leroy Hart was hanging around the camp, Scott, that day and went back and then stole the photos and the glasses and was walking around the crime scene when everyone shut it down at night. Who's to say?
Right.
He was in the area. The dogs were confused, saying that the scent was everywhere. It would make sense.
I have a question about the dogs. Mm-hmm. So were they going off of a scent from
the semen sample? Because I think what they do is they give the scent of the girls as well.
Because I was wondering if they had gotten a scent from the cave.
I think they actually, they did take the dogs to the cave. They indicated a scent, but it could have been for the blood of the girls as well.
So there was really no way for the dogs to be connected to Hart.
I don't believe that they brought anything of Hart to mm-hmm. the dogs and had them smell. And then we would have never known because it was in 3 days.
So are you coming back to the semen before mm-hmm. I ask questions?
Yeah, we're going back to it. But on June 4th, 1979, Hart collapses in the jail yard after working out and dies of a heart attack. 36 years old.
Whoa.
His biological brother had died of a heart attack at the same age.
So
in the early 2000s, with the advancements in DNA technology, funds were raised for more testing of all of the evidence that was collected at the crime scene. This meant over 400 pieces of evidence needed to be tested, and that cost a lot of money. And at that point in time, again, DNA was still developing. In 2012, a new sheriff took over the Mays County position, and he immediately reopened the case and began working on funding and reexamining every piece of it. And these are his findings. I'm going to give you a trigger warning because I am going to get into the details, and it's really rough because it's details that were not released until this point. So trigger warning for this, discussing the girls. This is what his conclusions were after reexamining everything. Whoever did this, the suspect, we're just going to call the person the suspect, was targeting one of the girls. Because of what the crime scene suggests, the order in which they were killed, the way that the blood patterns in the tent show, and the way that he opened up the tent number 7 before going to tent number 8.
Right. With the flashlight
looking
searching
for yeah. someone. And police now believe that it was Denise being targeted. Discussing more and more details about her attack that were really never released to the public. She was taped and tied to the tree where she was found. She was gagged, and the blow that she took to her head in the tent was not a death blow. It was not meant to kill her. It was meant to incapacitate her. Whereas Lori and Michelle's was an obvious single death blow. Denise was then bound, gagged with a pulley system for like control, and raped at the tree where she was tied up, which exactly matched the condition of the women who Jean Leroy Hart admittedly raped and kidnapped in 1966 when they were found and what they described.
Which of the girls wore glasses?
Michelle. No one knows why he would have targeted Denise. They had no prior connections, but this was clearly a premeditated murder for reasons that I haven't gotten into yet, but I'm about to. In 2017, $30,000 were raised for DNA testing with the help of private donors and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at the direction of the new sheriff of Mays County. And he's on the Keeper of the Ashes. He seems like a really good dude. I don't know anything about him, but like from what he's done for this case, he's done a lot of good. Out of those 300 pieces of evidence, they were able to find two DNA samples that were viable. The semen sample, number one, and number two, they found rooted hairs belonging to a male from the tent, and they tested it. The results came back in 2019. However, they have never been fully released to the public, and they won't be until the family members are okay with it. According to a 2022 release, though, the DNA testing was ruled officially inconclusive. It strongly suggests that Hart was involved, and the findings and the reports that they do have from these samples rule out all other persons of interest or suspects that they've ever had in the case.
So there were other suspects then?
They did have other suspects. OSBI, FBI did handle other suspects. And like after his arrest, they did pursue many other people, but they had no fucking evidence now.
Yeah.
To be able to prove anyone else.
Right, because they focused on one.
Yep. Okay, so this is where we come into the lawsuits, the legacies, and specifically the ways that the camp fucked up. Less than 2 months before the murders took place, during an on-site training session for the counselors at Camp Scott, a counselor discovered that her belongings had been completely thrown around and gone through in her cabin, and her donuts had been stolen. Inside of the empty donut box that was left behind, there was a handwritten note stating in capital letters, quote, "We are on a mission to kill three girls in tent one," end quote. The director of the camp stated that they treated it as a prank and it was completely discarded.
We are on a mission.
We. And then the day that they all arrived, June 12th, 1977, tent number seven, I don't know if this is referring to tent number eight where the girls were murdered or tent number seven, the one that was right beside them that got the door ripped open on them. Some reports say that written on the wall of it was kill, but for sure there was a knife cut through it. And no one did anything or told anyone.
Still a prank at that point?
Still a prank at that point. Two of the families later sued the Magic Empire Council, which was like the head of the Tulsa Girl Scout Council, and its insurers for $5 million alleging negligence. The civil trial included discussion of the threatening note and the fact that tent number seven, tent number eight, where the girls were murdered, was 86 yards from the counselor's tent. In 1985, by a 9-3 vote, jurors decided in the favor of the Magic Empire.
No way.
Yeah. Also, I forgot to note, one of the other things that came out about the Girl Scout at Camp Scott, after this, by the way, Camp Scott was evacuated and shut down. It's like abandoned to this day. One of the things that came out was that, you know how I told you that the police got the call at 7 and they made the discovery of the bodies at 6?
Mm-hmm.
They called their insurance company before they called the police, before they called the family, and they called their attorney and their insurance company.
And Denise possibly
might have been alive.
Wow.
Negligence
all around.
Negligence. Richard Gousset, the father of Michelle, went on to help the state legislature pass the Oklahoma Victims Bill of Rights. He also helped found the Oklahoma Crime Victims Compensation Board. Sherry Farmer, Lori's mother, founded the Oklahoma chapter of Parents of Murdered Children, which is a support group, to help educate other parents of victims about what you do and how you live.
Wow, dude.
As a result of the Supreme Court case, McGirt versus Oklahoma 2021, which determined that crimes involving Cherokee natives on Cherokee lands in Oklahoma fell under tribal rather than state sovereignty, new details about the killings are being released and investigated by Cherokee Nation now. Writer Faith Phillips stated that she had obtained a written confession of the killings from a Cherokee native, which as of July 2023 is under investigation and review of the FBI along with Cherokee Nation, but the case has not been closed. So they have a new suspect as of 3 days ago.
I mean, it crushes me that the girls don't have justice, but I just don't even, like, I'm at a loss for words. I don't even know
that's
my thoughts, like, on this case. Like, I feel like I need to watch every little thing about it and, like, get every single detail that they have, like, to even come with my own conclusion here, because I have no idea.
There is truly, like,
there's so much wrongdoing in every end.
And it's because the Mays County Sheriff's Department fucked up.
Yeah.
These little girls, Lori, Denise, and Michelle, their story should not be told in way.
Yeah.
Why is this tagged to their names? It shouldn't be. It should be that they shouldn't have been murdered. They shouldn't have been. But instead, to this day, they have no justice. And they're just the Oklahoma Girl Scouts.
That's sad.
So bad. So that's the case.
You did it really well. You did it respectfully. You did it well. You, like, seriously impressed. Like, that was incredible how you did that.
I would be too.
I don't know how you did that, but you did it.
It was rough. And I hope you guys are okay. And we'll see you guys next Thursday. And we love you. Next Thursday is episode 149, which is our last episode before 150. And guys, we don't have anything planned.
We don't.
So don't get your hopes up. Don't fucking think that anything big is going to happen. We wanted something big to happen. No one ever took us seriously when we talked about it. So
everyone hates us. So love you. Bye.
I love you. Bye.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.